We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. Or visit preborn.com.
The feature-length documentary Culture Warrior, Don Wildman and the Battle for Decency, premiering November 11th, chronicles the life and ministry of Don Wildman. It takes you through the founding of the National Federation for Decency, what has become AFA. It's a call to stand firm for righteousness and shows how that resolve can make a huge difference in our world.
If we lose this cultural war, we're going to have a hedonistic, humanistic society.
Find out more and watch the trailer at culturewarrior.movie.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government.
I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
We are tomorrow announcing and giving all of the Kennedy files. So people have been waiting for decades for this, and I've instructed my people that are responsible, lots of different people put together by Tulsi Gabbard, and that's going to be released tomorrow.
So that was President Trump yesterday at the Kennedy Center. Today is Tuesday, March 18th, and good morning. And that wasn't even the most controversial thing or the most the biggest news story of the day yesterday, which just seems to be, you know, a regular Tuesday for Donald Trump, right? Because he also posted this on social media regarding the pardons that Joe Biden signed while in office. He said this: the pardons that Sleepy Joe gave to the Unselect Committee of Political Thugs and many others are hereby declared void, vacant, and of no further force or effect because of the fact that they were done by AutoPen. In other words, Joe Biden did not sign them, but more importantly, he did not know anything about them. The necessary pardoning documents were not explained to or approved by Biden. So he goes on to kind of make his case there on social media. And Attorney General Andrew Bailey of the state of Missouri joined me last week because he actually had already sent a letter to the solicitor, the special investigator at the DOJ, talking about opening an investigation for exactly this purpose. This is what he had to say last week. Cut to.
This was more an issue of putting this on the radar and beginning to have the conversation to try to demand transparency and to establish the fact that we're talking about a fraud perpetrated on the American people of constitutional proportion. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, claims like this are raised in probate courts across the United States of America to challenge testamentary instruments like a will. If somebody signs a will prior to their demise dispersing assets and they weren't of right mind when they signed it, then the person that missed out on those assets can challenge that the signature on that document. And it's the same thing here, except it's worse because we're not talking about the dispersion of assets. We're talking about the exercise of constitutional authority that under Article 2 is vested in a singular president of the United States. So if Joe Biden wasn't signing the documents, didn't know what he was signing, didn't understand the implications, who was running the government? Those people need to be identified and held accountable. And again, it calls into question the legal validity of all of the documents that President Biden signed.
So joining me now to discuss more is Michael Donnelly, who is a law professor and attorney. So, Mike, a lot going on here, and it seems the focus of the media is on the AutoPen. I personally don't think that that's the bigger issue. I think, as A.G. Bailey said, it's more about whether or not Joe Biden actually knew, because the Constitution does say that the power of pardon is vested in a president of the United States, not just his staff to carry out what they assume to be his will. I mean, the order would have to come directly from Biden. And if he didn't know about it, he didn't authorize it, he didn't actually issue those pardons himself, then that would call into question the legal validity. But what is your take? And good morning.
Good morning, Jenna. Always great to be with you and your folks out there. Good morning to everyone. And You know, this is a constitutional law professor's dream if it weren't of such great consequence with what we're witnessing here in our country. And even then, I think it's fantastic for the American people to be thinking about our founding document. You know, as Christians, we have a founding document. We read it every day, or we should be. And as Americans, we have a founding document. It's called the Constitution of the United States. And we ought to be reading it and thinking about it. And these situations which pop up and prompt people to go back to the Constitution and say, well, wait a minute, what does it say? And what have we done? These are great questions, and I'm just so delighted we have the opportunity to talk about that. And they are of great importance. And so you ask the question, what's my take? Well, you know, this is a pretty in the weeds question. And I think there's a lot of thinking that we need to do about this, and we need to think about it principally. We need to look at what the Constitution says and also what it doesn't say, what has past practice been. And I'll also make this observation. We, the American people, get the government we elect. We elected Joe Biden. And we need to remember that. And as we take actions to try to fix things that are broken, like what President Trump is doing to defend our country by sending criminals and who were involved in an invasion of our country away, exercising his Article 2 powers under the Constitution. We need to be very supportive of that, in my opinion. I think he's exercising his powers appropriately, and judges who are trying to restrain him are acting extrajudicially. In the case of the pardons and the auto pen, you know, it's funny. I was thinking about this. You know, Obama did that. President Bush did that. You know, Obama famously said, I've got a pen and a phone. Well, apparently Obama didn't use his pen personally. He had an auto pen as well. And so we have a practice of presidents, you know, going back quite a ways, of using other means other than their own hand to sign documents, not even just pardons, but also laws, which I actually have a problem with, because Article 1, Section 7 talks about the presentment clause, and it actually says he shall sign. And while the Bush administration in 2005 put out a very detailed 30-page memo, which I read, and it's very interesting talking about where in the common law, you know, this idea of sign and what does it mean to sign something and can someone else sign something for you? And the answer is, yeah, you can. But I think, you know, the Constitution says the president shall sign laws. And so I think he should be signing them himself. But in the other section, Article 2, where it talks about pardons and commissions, which are things the president signs, it doesn't say he shall sign. Now, does that mean that if Joe Biden didn't know what he was doing, that he can delegate that non-authority? I don't think so. The court has said that the pardon power is non-delegable. And so the president does have to direct pardons. And that means now that there's a lot of authority. It's plenary. We've talked about this, Jenny. You and I talked about this not too long ago. It's plenary authority. The courts grant great discretion and deference to the president when he gives pardons to people. You know, people think that, you know, he can pardon himself, or he can pardon great swaths of people, like Jimmy Carter pardoned all the draft dodgers. And Biden actually has exercised a pardon power, you know, unless you include the draft dodgers, pardon has pardoned more people than any other president. Did he know that he was doing that? I think that's a fair question, because you can't delegate the pardon power to someone else, but he could say, look, I want to pardon all the J6 committee people. If he said that, that's evidence of his intent. And I think even if he didn't personally sign the pardon document, I think the pardon exists. If there's evidence that he was completely unaware and did not authorize or direct a pardon for a particular person or a particular group of people, then I think what Mr. Bailey said is appropriate, that there should be an investigation. So that's a long way of saying that's my take on it.
So I'm talking with Mike Donnelly, who is a law professor and an attorney. And I think you're right. And I was laughing at you saying, you know, this is a law professor's dream. I mean, I can just see the hypotheticals for future law students around this issue to say, you know, well, what's your take on it? And it's a great legal and constitutional question. But where does this go from here? I mean, if the DOJ decides to investigate, what type of evidence would they have to show? Because Bailey also made the point that Biden's own DOJ said in their report that he wasn't even mentally sound enough to stand impeachment trial over the documents that were found at his house. I mean, so, you know, we already have some evidence of his mental incapacity more broadly. And so it would stand to reason that there could be some way to invalidate these pardons. But I think you're right, Mike, that we need to tread carefully, and it shouldn't just be a matter of, well, you know, we, the conservatives, don't like those pardons, so we want to try to find any way to revoke them, because, you know, bad facts make bad law, as they say. And even if we don't like them, you're right, Joe Biden was the president, and he has the constitutional authority. The question should be...
Well, he was occupying the White House, right?
Right. But so the question, though, is, did he actually exercise it? And should there be precedent that a president has to show, like physically signing or at least making it a statement or some kind of proof that this is actually coming from their direction, not what we saw over the 4 years of Joe Biden with so many other things as well?
Yeah, I mean, where do we go from here? I mean, I think it's appropriate for there to be an investigation. And, you know, that's fine. You know, the president can direct the DOJ to investigate. I mean, I guess solicitors general who may want to bring or attorneys general, perhaps, who want to criminally prosecute people who would maybe be guilty of crimes for which they've been pardoned. And if they're alleging or stating that, look, this person did this crime, maybe a conspiracy or something, you know a little bit about how that all goes down. You got some personal experience with that, you know, and maybe they want to prosecute one of these J6 committee members or, you know, Adam Schiff or whatever. I don't know. Somebody who they think committed a crime, but the person was pardoned. So one, they could prosecute the person and just say, look, we think this pardon is invalid, so we're going to prosecute, and then work that out in the court. Or they could investigate first and say, well, we're not sure the pardon is valid, so let's investigate whether the pardon was actually authorized or not. If there's evidence that it wasn't authorized, then maybe you bring the case and you sort it out through the criminal process. You know, you're going to have somebody who's going to have criminal due process protections, and it'll get argued, and it'll take years to get to that. You know, the pardon power has been litigated a little bit. You know, I think it's appropriate for us to explore this. We are in some uncharted territory here when it comes to a president who there are grave doubts about his mental acuity, competence. But I also go back to the fact that that's also kind of a political question, Jenna, and the courts don't like to answer political questions because we, the people of the United States, allegedly at least, elected Joe Biden, and he took the oath of office, and he exercised the power of the presidency for 4 years, like it or not. We could have impeached him or tried to, could have removed him under Article 25, didn't. Okay, you know, those are hard things to do, but you don't bring down an entire republic over one person. Nevertheless, I do think it's appropriate to investigate these questions. I think they should be investigated. It's constitutionally appropriate. If there are, you know, a lot of people suspect that there were some conspiracies, some crimes that were committed, and they should be investigated. These people who perpetrated some of these crimes, going back to the issues of the first Trump administration, his impeachment, and was there criminal conspiracy, and, you know, what was happening then, and suddenly Joe Biden pardons all those people, and, you know, are those pardons, you know, should they be considered effective when the person who was doing them wasn't competent? Maybe not. I will say one thing, though, when you played the Mr. Bailey's thing, there is a difference between a will in state law and a pardon under federal constitutional law. And yes, both are important and they affect rights, but they are different. I'm not sure I like the idea of conflating those two things. One's state law, one's federal law, and I think we need to keep our mind clear on that. There's also common law consideration, so I'm not sure I like that comparison.
And this is why if you go to five lawyers for listeners, unlike the five dentists where you only have four generally that agree and the one outlier, if you go to five different lawyers, you'll have five different answers. And this is why we all love to debate and discuss these things, because everybody has a little bit different take in how you analogize versus you contrast, and all of these different concepts and principles, I think is different depending on how you view the law and also the priority that you place on it. And you're right, Mike Donnelly, I think to say that this needs to be balanced. It shouldn't just be let's go full bore and try to get the pardons invalidated for their own sake because we don't like those or we think that Joe Biden shouldn't have issued those. The shouldn't question is the political question. And unfortunately, that was answered with Joe Biden taking the oath of office. So this is a matter of precedent. We have to look forward to what the law calls, the ex ante or the precedential value of this. Could this ultimately harm the power that the founders provided in Article 2 if we tend to abrogate it in this way? I mean, so all of these questions, I think, are important, but it's an important question, I think, for a court to eventually determine. And if there is sufficient evidence to bring about such a challenge, it is important that we have due process around this. But before we run out of time, speaking of due process, I want to get your take on another issue that President Trump seems to not care about due process. And, I tend to agree with him in this one, where this is coming from The Washington Times. President Trump invoked a centuries-old law to quickly detain and deport all Venezuelan migrants who are suspected of being part of the Tren de Aragua gang. Trump enacted the 1798 Alien Enemies Act, which effectively treats suspected gang members like wartime enemies of the U.S. government, giving the Trump administration the power to arrest, detain, and deport them with no due process. This is, of course, going to be challenged and already is being challenged in court, but the White House appears to welcome that challenge. This is what the White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt had to say yesterday on this issue. Cut three.
This administration acted within the confines of the law, again, within the president's constitutional authority and under the authority granted to him under the Alien Enemies Act. We are quite confident in that, and we are wholly confident that we are going to win this case in court.
So, Mike, your thoughts on using, I mean, I don't mind that he's using an antiquated law that hasn't, I mean, laws are still laws if they're still valid. But in this case, should there be due process for illegal aliens? I think that's really the question.
Yeah, I like what you said. An antiquated law is a law. A law is a law. And this law comes from the very founding of our country, the Alien Enemies Act. And it's interesting, it was passed at the same time the Sedition Act was passed, which a lot of people didn't like that. I didn't like the Sedition Act. This was set historically in the quasi-war that we were concerned was going to happen with France. And so John Adams, who was president at the time, the Federalist, who I like in a lot of ways, but I didn't like that he wanted to have a powerful central government, which you and I have talked about. I think the central government, the federal government, is the biggest threat to our liberty, and so we need to cut it back. But he passed that because of that reason, concerned about people coming here to engage in acts of war. And it's not just war that the Alien Enemies Act deals with, as Carolyn Leavitt appropriately talked about. It's incursions, predatory incursions or invasions. And the president has exercised his authority under that act, and I think under Article 2 of the Constitution, to recognize that we are being invaded. There is evidence that the Venezuelan government directed some of this, which kind of meets some of the conditions of the law. And he is exercising authority to detain and remove these people who are here illegally. And it applies to non-citizens. There is a lot of hysteria going on with respect to this Alien Enemies Act. People need to just calm down and they need to read the act. It's very short. It's one paragraph. People can read it. The other thing I think people can do, and to my friends listening right now, just go to my tweet or X page at Donnelly Speaks. And I'm stalking Stephen Miller these days because I love watching him on CNN and TV. And I got three of his videos from yesterday posted on my at Donnelly Speaks X account. And you can watch him. He does a fantastic job of explaining what's at stake. And I think the president is right to use the Alien Enemies Act to remove criminals who are a danger to our national security and to the safety of our citizens. So I'm fine with it. I don't think people who are here illegally non-citizens who pose that kind of national security threat are due process under the U.S. Constitution. It's my opinion.
I agree with you on that. And the argument appears to be with at least some of the chatter that I've seen on X as well from the leftists, saying that there is a difference between those who have been criminally convicted versus suspected gang members. And I don't think that that's where we parse the issue. To me, it's,
agreed,
are you here illegally or not? And I don't care if you're a violent criminal, you're convicted, you're suspected of being a gang, whatever. You can be deported without due process, just one and done. That's fine. And obviously, I like that Trump is prioritizing violent criminals and people who pose an even increased threat. But even like what we saw in Florida with the report that was released just last week saying that $660 million of Florida's annual budget just in 2024 was unrecoverable and spent on medical supplies and services given to undocumented citizens and illegals and, you know, people who are non-citizens for emergency room visits. And, you know, so even for people who aren't violent, they're still taking part in a country, and they're, I mean, that to me is theft. I mean, they're taking that, they don't have insurance, they're still using the resources of our society illegally. And so in my mind, it's, if you're here illegally, you are subject to deportation regardless of whether you've been a model citizen here or not, because you're not a citizen. So so that's where I would draw the line. And I think that that's where Trump draws the line. Do you think that's where the courts will draw the line?
Well, I think they will. The INA, the Alien Enemies Act and the Immigration Naturalization Act give the president and his secretaries great authority to act. Yes, there are procedures when people come for asylum claims to adjudicate those claims, but that's different. When you've got people here who are not or who have bogus asylum claims or who have committed crimes, the president has a lot of authority to be able to deport those people, and he should. So I feel like, you know, we'll see what the courts say. I mean, they may parse it a little bit. I think you're right about that. At the end of the day, though, we're talking about the Alien Enemies Act and the use of it to get rid of people who are threats to our national security and who are threats to the safety of American citizens. And it doesn't seem like there should be much debate about that. Those people don't deserve, they don't get any kind of due process. They're here illegally, they're committing crimes, they're a threat to national security. And for him to put them on a plane and for a district court judge to have the arrogance and political motivation to try to stop that, to me, is a greater issue than him removing these threats to our national security and safety.
Well said. And I approve of Congressman Brandon Gill, who is filing impeachment articles against that judge. I think if we held rogue judges more accountable when they are extra constitutional and they are more political, then hopefully we would get a judiciary that would actually follow the law and the Constitution, because that's ultimately what the judicial branch is for, to keep the two political branches in check. And if they become a political branch themselves, well, then where is the judiciary to restrain them? That's why we have the power of impeachment. So all of this, it's so fascinating. Wish we had more time, Mike Donnelly. We'll have to have you on the podcast side soon so we can do an even deeper dive into these issues. But we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. As we celebrate the many pro-life victories going forward, we rejoice. Preborn's network of clinics have a unique opportunity to advance even further without political persecution. But what does this look like? Preborn is the greatest threat to the abortion industry by rescuing on average 200 babies' lives a day, and they are putting a serious dent into the abortion holocaust. But there are still thousands of babies who are slain daily, and Preborn's goal is to rescue them all. With the help of the pro-life community, meaning you and me, we can save so many more. Please join us in saving all of these precious lives. The ultrasound is the game changer. Once a mother hears that precious heartbeat, she is twice as likely to choose life. If you consider yourself pro-life, we need your help. One ultrasound is just $28. Five ultrasounds are $140. $5,000 sponsors ultrasounds for the entire Preborn network for an entire day. So how many lives can you save? Every child is a beautiful gift from God, so please join this cause. To donate securely, please dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And many of those announcements that we just talked about in the prior segment came from President Trump as he headed to the Kennedy Center yesterday for the first time since he became chairman of the board. He toured the Kennedy Center, presided over a board meeting following a shakeup, according to The Hill. And so it's a great step toward cultural renewal, perhaps, in the United States after years of all of these ridiculous priorities at the Kennedy Center. It was founded to be a premier cultural center and a beacon for American greatness in performing arts and entertainment and theater. But it's become a vehicle for ideological crusades. And this includes things like drag queen performances aimed at kids. There's on the Kennedy Center homepage, in fact, there's a drag queen called Lil Miss Hot Mess that apparently serves on the board of Drag Queen Story Hour. And why is this at the Kennedy Center and in the middle of American culture and arts? Well, joining me now to discuss is Dr. Zach Marshall, who is a campus reform editor in chief. So, Dr. Marshall, thanks so much for joining. And I think while the left is screeching about the Kennedy Center, and I saw an article that performances of, I think it was Hamilton on Broadway, were now not going to go to the Kennedy Center because they think this is too political. Well, the left has been using the Kennedy Center to advance their own ideology and politics for a very long time. So this is just coming back to actual arts and entertainment, not a worldview aimed at children.
Yeah, it's great to be here. And you're absolutely right. I'm so sick of the pearl clutching going on from the left because it is such hypocrisy and such a lack of self-awareness on their part. The problem with the Kennedy Center with the drag queens, as you mentioned, with Little Miss Hot Mess and other social initiatives they've done, which promote artists and programs because those things conform to leftist ideologies or preferred identities, is that the leaders who have been running the Kennedy Center for the last 5 to 10 years don't realize that they've been putting forth Black Lives Matter, anti-racism statements, transgender ideology as these politically or value-neutral viewpoints that everyone must abide by and also go along with. They don't see that as a political ideology that is a litmus test for access, not only just to be part of the Kennedy Center, but be part of its leadership, to be among its honorees. One of the changes that happened after Trump's takeover was that the Gay Men's Chorus is no longer performing at the Kennedy Center because that performance was connected to Pride. And that is such a I think a linchpin issue here is that Pride has become a politicized event every June in D.C. across the country that tells people we have to accept other people's pronouns. We have to believe that there are more than two genders. So this is, I think, the sins of the left, the Kennedy Center, coming home to roost.
Yeah, well said. And it's always fascinating to me, Dr. Marshall, that the left can advance their worldview and their religion, which of course is derived from Marxism, and you know their whole view of the LGBTQ agenda, all of that. And yet, when conservatives want to come back to truth and beauty and actual, you know, the science of art, if you will, then suddenly, oh, don't force your values on me, and how dare you? I mean, Vice President J.D. Vance was actually booed at the Kennedy Center. And I find that just so incredibly hypocritical that the left has been advancing their religion for decades and trying to foist it on the entire culture through art, through politics, through every other mechanism, I mean, through the classroom. And yet when we're just saying as conservatives, well, hold on a second, you can't do that. And especially when it comes to a lot of this vulgarity for children, then, you know, suddenly it's, well, you know, you get your Christianity out of politics and out of entertainment. So where is the conservative balance here to be able to respond to those types of accusations?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think we have to look at how far the left has drifted leftward, and it is now so detached from where
most of America is. Let's not forget that the Kennedy Center, as America's premier performing arts center, was founded in 1971, a bipartisan effort. There has been consensus in this country for the last 70 years between center-left Democrats, center-right Republicans, and centrists across America that there is a role for government to fund and support the arts, because there is a role for arts and culture in our society to enrich our lives, to help with tourism, and to bring us together. That has been a consensus for decades, and now this far left wants to put a litmus test on there and say, we're only going to hire you if you say that Black Lives Matter. We're only going to honor you if you also virtue signal the way we do. So it's not just that there's a lack of conservatives among the Kennedy Center honorees or among the staff at Kennedy Center, which there is, but also there's a lack of artists and performers and staff who are not promoting the leftist agenda, and that has to stop. We have to go back to depoliticalization of the arts, and that is where we have a broad range of viewpoint diversity and people of all backgrounds having access to the best performances and being able to feel that the Kennedy Center is for them and don't feel excluded because they don't exactly agree with what the president of the building thinks.
And I'm speaking with Dr. Zach Marshall, who is Campus Reform's editor-in-chief, and his op-ed on this topic is in the Washington Times. You can read it. The title is Kennedy Center Shakeup is Good News for American Culture and Arts. And what would you say, Dr. Marshall, to perhaps, you know, some on the right who say, well, you know, entertainment and culture and art, it, you know, it's just kind of weird, and it's for, you know, it's kind of geared toward the left anyway. What does it matter if conservatives are engaged in theater or in the arts and entertainment? I mean, we want to be, you know, just on involved in concrete ideas and philosophy. You know, we don't need the arts.
I would tell them that if they want to read any good conservative philosopher or thinker of the last 100 years, all those writers are carving out time in enriched, cultivated lives for leisure, for the pursuit of knowledge. And that comes through entertainment and also through the exceptional artistic expressions that are separate from our ordinary experiences. This is what makes us fully rounded human beings. So there is a place for theater, for opera, for music, in addition to political philosophy and religion. It's what makes us complete human beings. And that is why it's so important that access to the arts is democratized and people of all backgrounds can have opportunities to engage with it as they want to. The problem that we're seeing right now is that there's always been a lack of geographic diversity in this country because so many of the leftists in the Northeast and California are the ones who are controlling arts programming. During the Whitney Biennial, for example, the Art Museum in New York does a huge showcase every 2 years, and there was a report a few years ago that while, you know, they had huge numbers of ethnic, racial, gender diversity among its artists, about two-thirds of the people displayed there came from Brooklyn and Manhattan. That is not diversity. That does not reflect what the leisure of people in the middle of the country in rural communities looks like and feels like. And more of that needs to be represented at the Kennedy Center.
Yeah, well said. And, you know, and I think that it's absolutely true that we need to get more people engaged from different backgrounds and perspectives. When you look at how Hollywood has just completely monopolized the movie industry, I mean, this is why then you have entertainment that's only driving the messages of the left. And it shouldn't just be that the Oscars are, you know, given to all of these leftists to spout their propaganda. The arts should belong to everyone. And, you know, our God is an artistic, creative Lord, and when we engage in things that are good, that are wholesome, and express that creativity, we're expressing an aspect of the character and nature of our Creator. So we should be engaged in this. But thanks so much to Dr. Marshall. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, let's turn to pro-life and where we are at in the fight for life. So Advancing American Freedom is leading pro-life groups and calling on the House GOP to repeal the FACE Act. You remember this Clinton-era law that was weaponized by Joe Biden against pro-lifers, and it must go. This group is urging the House GOP. And so a number of organizations, including the American Family Association, has signed on to this letter to the members of the House Judiciary Committee. It says this: the pro-life movement is grateful for President Trump's decisive action to pardon the FACE Act prisoners. These pro-life Americans were unjustly targeted by the Biden administration's Department of Justice for their efforts to protect the most vulnerable in our society, unborn human beings. Congress must do its part to support President Trump's effort to end the weaponization of government by repealing the FACE Act in its entirety. So Jonah Wendt is a policy advisor for Advancing American Freedom, and he joins me now. So Jonah, this is just yet another instance where Congress really does need to codify President Trump's agenda and the mandate that the American people gave, not just to the executive branch, but I think to Congress as well, when we saw the landslide results in 2024. So where is Congress at when they're dealing, you know, with other priorities like releasing, you know, the JFK files today, which, okay, you know, great, that's interesting and all that, but I'm much more interested, honestly, in priorities like this. And do we have Jonah? Apparently we do not have Jonah, but we will try. I'll have my producers try to get him back on the line since we are supposed to have him. But anyway, you know, I'll answer my own question. I think that where Congress is at is that they need to prioritize all of this. We have all of the issue over the continuing resolution, the budget. There's been so much emphasis on DOGE and, you know, so many of these different priorities. But it seems that Congress in some ways, I think, is kind of just riding in sort of the draft that of the winds that the executive branch and President Trump is doing in terms of the headlines. And so while they're continuing to go full steam ahead, Congress needs to prioritize some of these things, but it's going to take a filibuster-proof conservative majority. And I've talked about this quite a bit, actually, but for maybe people who aren't regular listeners or even for regular listeners, that we can continue to prioritize this heading into the midterms next year. That's really, in my view, where the rubber meets the road on this, because if we do not have a conservative majority in the Senate, it's going to be a lot more difficult to codify a lot of these wins. And you never know after 4 years what the next election will bring. And as Ronald Reagan very famously said, you know, we're only, you know, one generation, but I would say one election away from having, you know, liberty infringed on. And so we need to ensure that Congress makes these things a priority. And we need to make sure that some of these Republicans that they actually act conservatively, because Republican doesn't mean conservative. And I don't like dividing Congress just into Republican versus Democrat and suggesting that all Republicans do all the right things all the time. That's just not true if we're using conservatism and especially a biblical standard. And I'm told that we do have Jonah Wendt, who is the policy advisor for Advancing American Freedom. So let's continue the conversation with him. And Jonah, I was talking about how Congress really needs to codify a lot of these significant wins and priorities, because if all they're doing is kind of pointing at the executive and saying, you know, yay, you go and you're doing so many great things and they're all in the headlines, Congress kind of seems to be given a pass right now a little bit. Where are they at in terms of doing some of these things that only Congress can effectuate and prioritize?
Good morning, Jenna. Thank you for having me on. And that's exactly right. What we're seeing here is that President Trump is going, he and his new administration are going gangbusters, but Congress is sort of just sitting there and saying, well, this is great. We're not going to do anything with it. They've got to be codifying these EOs. They've got to be making permanent what President Trump is doing, because, you know, if the next election comes around and Democrats win, everything we saw the Biden administration doing in terms of weaponization of government, opening up the border, that's all going to happen again unless you actually change the law. So, and the FACE Act is a great example of this. You know, President Trump came in, he pardons the FACE Act prisoners, and then he issues new guidance basically saying you can only use the FACE Act under extraordinary circumstances, and that's great for the next 4 years. Unfortunately, if you do not repeal the FACE Act, it sits there on the books just waiting for the next Democrat administration to come in and once again weaponize it against the pro-life Americans. And if you think Democrats aren't going to do it, you've got to wake up. Like, the Democrats are really upset with the way President Trump is actually driving the agenda for once. And you can't believe for 1 minute that they take back power and they don't immediately go back to throwing every pro-lifer they can find in a paddy wagon.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely true that the Democrats and the leftists aren't just sitting here saying, oh, well, you know, we totally lost. Our party is in shambles and we're going to just go and cry in a corner. They are not going to just let Trump have a lot of these wins and just let America continue to build back up into a better, more conservative, more perfect union, as it were. They're going to try to come back and foist their agenda back on America in various ways. And I hope that they will not be successful in doing that. But because their ideology is obviously not from a biblical worldview and is not what is ultimately best for America. And for things like the FACE Act to be so weaponized is so egregiously against people who have a right to do what these pro-lifers are doing. So where is this, though, in terms of the priorities? I mean, Representative Chip Roy has been outspoken on this. You know, others have as well. But it doesn't seem like Congress is actually taking any action, at least not yet.
Yeah, so Congressman Chip Roy and Senator Mike Lee have been doing great work on the FACE Act. They've been conducting oversight for since it started being abused against Mark Houck, you know, 3-4 years ago. And so it's been reintroduced in both the House and the Senate. And Chip Roy is really championing the bill. It's his bill. He's led it for years. This is an issue he cares deeply about. He's been championing it in the House, and they're hoping to, it might not get marked up now, but they're hoping to get a markup sometime this year. The question is, there's a couple of House GOP judiciary members that are a little, oh, we're not sure we support the FACE, we're feeling the FACE Act. So that's part of the impetus for this letter, is that we're trying to show these members of Congress, like, this is the way forward for the pro-life movement. It's no secret the pro-life movement has been a little shattered over the past year, and there's been questions like what strategies to pursue. But on the FACE Act, the pro-life movement is unified. It's got to go. This is an easy win. You've got, it's a weaponized law. How many Americans think that the FBI should show up on somebody's front porch just because they happen to be pro-life? The United States has a rich history of civil disobedience. That's generally speaking what these people are doing who've been arrested for the FACE Act. And if you don't repeal the law, it will come back to bite us in the butt again.
Well, so where are Republicans, I mean, what even is their rationale for saying, you know, oh, we're not sure that we should repeal the FACE Act? I mean, what could possibly be their logic for that?
Yeah, so I think that there's some who might be in swing districts who are a little concerned this could go nuclear on them come election season, because as you and your listeners know, Planned Parenthood spends, I think, what is it, $500 million a year on elections. Every election they put out, you know, $500 million. And I think a lot of members are concerned that that's going to get dropped on them and that they support, you know, all sorts of heinous things simply because they support repealing the FACE Act. And to, you know, give a quick brief on the FACE Act to your listeners, the FACE Act basically says if you are a nuisance or commit a crime involving abortion or an abortion provider, the FBI shows up on your front porch, it's now a federal crime. It's basically a hate crime statute that takes crimes that are committed at the local and state level and makes them federal issues. So you're federalizing state and local crime. You're violating police powers of the Constitution. It's constitutionally dubious, because your listeners know this, but when the FACE Act was originally passed, Roe v. Wade was law of the land, so there was a quote-unquote federal right to abortion. The Dobbs decision reversed that, so now there's no federal right to abortion. It has to subsist under the Commerce Clause. Since the Bill Clinton era law was passed, the Commerce Clause has been narrowed down, so that leg also doesn't really stand. And so if this law can be successfully challenged in court, I honestly think it could be overturned.
Well, and isn't it always the way, Jonah Wendt, my special guest this morning from Advancing American Freedom, that it always comes back to self-interest on a lot of these Republicans and, you know, and members who are saying, well, I'm in a swing district, as you mentioned, and so this could be politically difficult for me. Well, then what good are they doing in Congress anyway if they're not willing to stand up for what is right and represent conservatism and represent what should be the values of at least, you know, what the Republican Party suggests that they're all about. And if they're just concerned about the next election, then they're not doing anything that they were elected for to begin with. I mean, and obviously the flip side of that is saying, well, you know, if they're in a kind of swing district, then the representative view of that would suggest that maybe, you know, they are actually representing their constituents in that particular district. But at the same time, you know, we have representatives who go and they have to vote their conscience. They have to, yes, represent their district, but vote their conscience. And this is why, as I was, you know, saying while we were trying to get connected with you, I think that the midterms are really where it's going to be at to make sure that some of these people who aren't willing to stand for things like pro-life are ultimately primaried, so that we get people in office and that, you know, Republican or Democrat, I honestly really don't care. I want people and, you know, Democrats being conservative, that's a little bit of a stretch. But really, the point is that the party affiliation doesn't matter. It ultimately matters what their vote is. And I want to see more conservatives who will stand up for pro-life that are being elected to office so that we don't have challenges like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's 100% right. I think the American people respect courage and they respect leadership. Would you rather vote for a member of Congress that you disagree with, who you know is courageous and is leading on issues, or would you rather vote for a member of Congress who you know you may agree with a little bit more, but you know they don't have courage and they're not leading? I trust the American people. I trust that they respect courage and leadership, and I think there's honestly a vacuum of that in Washington. And so when you have representatives who are courageous and do lead, the American people respect that, and I think they do that at the ballot box.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where I would just encourage our listeners to be engaged in your districts and know, you know, who is running, what their voting record is, and, you know, whether they're someone that you would like to vote for again, or whether there should be a primary challenge or even a challenge in the general. I mean, I just had a young man who is running against Representative Jasmine Crockett in Texas, and I was appalled to hear that the only reason that she got elected as a Democrat was because her seat went totally unchallenged by the GOP. And so he's stepping in, but it's going to be harder now that she's an incumbent. And it's always harder, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat that you're trying to primary or even overturn in a general. It's just harder to unseat an incumbent. But this is why we need to be engaged at our level, and it requires the engagement of everyone and of we the people to manage our government as a whole and put people in office who are willing to stand up for pro-life. But Jenna Wendt, this also gets me to another question about the pro-life movement in general. We've seen that the Republican Party in 2024, and even President Trump, I'm glad to see that his campaign rhetoric didn't really match what he's doing on pro-life issues now that he's in office. That's actually a good thing. I think he's stronger on pro-life than a lot of us were concerned about. But do you think with the overall MAGA movement not being as grounded in biblical principles as much as just populism, that we need to refine our messaging on pro-life and to make it a winning issue again?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always down for new arguments. I think that there's ways you can make the pro-life argument pro-life. If you're worried about, you know, the man crushing the little guy, there's no situation that embodies that more than abortion. When you have, you know, a giant like Planned Parenthood, you know, crushing the skull of a small baby, it's inside of its mother, woman can't defend itself. So I think there's plenty of ways to make a populist argument to defend life.
Yeah, and I think that's true. But I think even more than that, I mean, where I'm driving at is maybe, you know, changing the messaging of not just talking about, you know, weeks of gestation or, you know, some of the science, but really talking about how much the abortion movement as a whole is genuinely taking advantage of and commoditizing women. I mean, that's their consumer base. Mm-hmm. And for so many women who really think that abortion is their only alternative, I think we could do better as an overall pro-life movement in advancing other choices, while abortion unfortunately still is legal in, you know, some states in some ways, and obviously we're having all of those policy conversations, where it still is a choice for women to say, well, that's not your only choice, that is just one and honestly the worst choice among all of the options that you have. And And instead of just talking about, you know, the science of it, talking about really the emotion and the heart of it.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I also think that, you know, we all know that the MAGA movement's very transactional. It's very, what can you bring to the table? What can you do for me? And Planned Parenthood spends millions and millions of dollars against the MAGA movement every year. They don't care if you're a MAGA or a conservative. They just want Democrats that are going to vote to kill babies in Washington. So if you want to, you know, Planned Parenthood's, what, top five spender against Republicans every year, easy? It's like you have, quote unquote, the enemy who's attacking you, and you're going to side with them by being moderately pro-abortion.
Yeah,
instead of being fully pro-life, like, they're spending millions of dollars against you guys. Just be pro-life. They're going to spend it against you whether or not, wherever you draw the line, as long as you're a Republican, they're spending against you.
Yeah, well said. Well, Jenna Wendt, thanks so much. And this article is in Fox News. You can read it, Clinton-era law weaponized by Biden. And you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. Have a great day.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.